ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। सो टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम कैंटो 7 चैप्टर 5 एंटाइटल्ड प्रहलाद द सेंटली सन ऑफ हिरण्यकश्यपु। टेक्स्ट 9। वत्स प्रहाद भद्रं ते सत्यं कथय मामृषा बालान् अतीकुतस्तुभ्यं एष बुद्धि विपर्यया। ट्रांसलेशन। डियर सन प्रहलाद, all peace and good fortune unto you. Kindly do not speak lies, just reply with the truth. These boys, you see, are not like you, for they do not speak in a deviant way. How have you learned these instructions? How has your intelligence been spoiled in this way? Purport. Prahlad Maharaj was still a boy, and therefore his teachers thought that if they pacified the little boy, he would immediately speak the truth, revealing the secret of how the Vaishnavas came there to teach him lessons in devotional service. It was surprising, of course, that in the same school the other boys of the Daityas were not polluted. Only Prahlad Mahar was supposedly polluted by the instruction of Vaishnavas. The main duty of the teachers was to inquire who those Vaishnavas were that came to teach Prahlad and spoil his intelligence. Hare Krishna. So we have very good fortune. One of the very senior and intimate disciples of His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada here, Her Grace Govindadasi Mataji. We all have heard about her. She has been a very, very senior and very, very intimate disciple of Srila Prabhupada. She rendered a lot of intimate services and spent a lot of personal time. And we also hear how in the fourth canto, right? Prabhupada mentions about her name for serving Tulsi Maharani in the Western countries. So we are very, very fortunate to have her here. Let us all welcome her by loudly chanting Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol.
Namaha Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutalaya Srimate Bhaktivinoda Swami Nitya Namani. I'm not at all qualified or prepared to speak anything on Srimad Bhagavatam, but somehow or other I'm here. So I will say something. Hopefully Srila Prabhupada can speak something of value through me, because I have nothing to say on my own. No. This temple is so beautiful. It's like an oasis. And this desert of Bombay, it's so beautiful. And when I'm coming in the car, it's been many years since I've been to Bombay, actually. Many, many years. I generally always fly into Delhi and go to Vrindavan straight away. But I came for the wonderful Bhaktivedanta Hospital. I came for some reason. I flew into Bombay. But when I came in, it was 12:30 at night, so I didn't see your city. And today I saw, and I was amazed at the direction that India has taken in the last 25 years. I was here many years ago with Srila Prabhupada when he was building Juhu. And I know his reason. I know his what he, many times he talked about how Bombay The people will go to the cinema on the weekends. The people are being influenced to go the Western way. But he wanted to have a cultural center where they could come, and Juhu, and of course now here, and be influenced toward the original culture of India. I see the signboards. I read every one of them on the way, and I was amazed that India has taken such a Western direction. And Prabhupada was so concerned about this. This was his great, I'm sure you know from what you've read, his great concern was for India and India losing her culture. He used to say that if there's a child who knows better, they will suffer much more than the child who is in ignorance. America is flatline ignorance. They don't have any... although I'm born in America, I'm obviously probably Indian in previous life, but in America there's no history of culture. There's no rishis and Sanskrit and thousands of years of realization that you have here. At least there is a belief in God, a basic belief in God, and so that's very good. That was the doorway for Prabhupada to enter the religious tolerance that exists in America. And of course, America was founded by those who were persecuted for religious reasons. I don't know if you know that, but the early settlers there. So that was the virtue of America. But culturally, missing. And India has everything. But India is copying. And Prabhupada saw this, and he saw the future. Sometime I even saw him with tears come down. He's so concerned for the future of this Bharat Varsha. And so when I see this oasis in the middle of this mad whirlwind of materialism that Bombay has become, I can see that it's Prabhupada's hand is working here through you. You have a big job ahead of you, but an important one. It's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. The darkness is there. We can certainly curse it, but to light candles, each one of us, there will be more candles lit, just like you are all candles. You're all bright candles that are lit to guide your culture. Prabhupada foresaw, he was so concerned for India that if India turns away from her native culture, she will suffer so much. And he foresaw this, and he talked about it many times. I'm sure you must have read this, yes? Haven't you? And so, I guess today, riding in the car, I got to see all the signboards. Things that would never have been on signboards 25 years ago, 30 years ago, when I came to India first in 76. And that's when he was building Bombay. There were not signboards like this at that time. There were these big signboards are like an advertisement for the culture that exists nowadays. And it was very shocking to me. So I'm wanting to somehow or other inspire you and encourage you to go on doing what you're doing in the matter of reaching the people, because each person reaches another 10 people, another 100 people, another like this. And this way Lord Chaitanya's movement is destined, already is destined to spread. Once Prabhupada wrote a letter to one Vaishnava, one of my godbrothers, and said, Lord Chaitanya's movement is going to spread for the next 10,000 years. It is predicted by God, so it is definitely going to happen. If you wish to help, then it's very good for you and good for the movement. If you don't, then somebody else will be there. So that's basically it. It will happen. but it's our good fortune if we're given this opportunity to do something for this movement. And in your case, to do something for your country of India. Bharatvarsha is a sacred land. It is a sacred place. And so many of the Indian youth are so confused. In America, I traveled to many Indian homes, and the children, I'm sure you know, they're called ABCDs. You've heard this term, ABCDs, American-born confused Deshis. Many of them are extremely lost. They can't fit in America, and they have lost their culture. So many of them are very, very confused. Oh, they may not be driving nice cars, and they may go to Harvard University, but their hearts are torn, and they have lost their way, lost their connection with their parents and with their homeland, with their motherland. It's improving, but that is a huge preaching potential for you Indian boys, Indian youths. The Indian youth in America need your help. They really need your help. And now they're becoming more proud of their culture, which is good. Before, they were simply feeling embarrassed. Many of the children, they don't want to know Hindi, they don't want to know Gujarati, they don't want to have any association with their grandmothers and their parents. It's a complete, because they go to the American school 5 days a week, they come home and watch American television, and they literally live on pizza. I've seen it firsthand. They want nothing to do with Indian spices or Indian culture. And this is what's happening. And these are, and some of them come back, especially the ones born in Bharatvarsha, and then they go to America at an early age. But the ones who are born in America are more lost. So I encourage you to carry on this work. And somehow or other, if you can expand your preaching programs there, it would be very good, because then many Indian youth who are confused will gravitate toward their original culture. They will have an identity. They're searching for an identity. They have the nice job, the nice car, the nice degree. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're engineers. They're getting all that, but they're not. Their heart is empty. So this is something that Srila Prabhupada wanted very much. He built this temple. He brought Americans to India for this purpose. He used to talk about so much how he wanted to bring the people of India back to their culture. So this has landed in your lap now. You are all emissaries for Prabhupada in that way. Is there any questions about, I don't know what to, that you'd like to know about Srila Prabhupada or anything like that? I don't hear well, so. Interaction with Srila Prabhupada? What aspect of that particularly?
As a secretary, Prabhuji says. As a secretary.
As a secretary? You mean when I was traveling with him?
Yeah.
Well, I can say that it was the best time of my life. That was a wonderful time of my life. It was like getting dessert first. You know, in America, they serve dessert last. And it was like getting the best part when you're young. But actually, I was a college student. I wasn't a hippie. I was in my fourth year of college, first semester. And due to a lot of circumstances, there was some violence committed at the college I was going to. It was at the University of Texas. And my husband and I went in search of a guru. We went in search of the truth. We had no idea where we were going. We just left in the middle of the semester on Thanksgiving. November, that's Thanksgiving. November, end of November. So we went, and we had no idea where we were going, but we went to San Francisco, and Prabhupada arrived there about a month later. And by that time, we were ready to meet him and ready to know who... At that time, there were no temples. It's hard to imagine, but it was before the Bhagavad Gita was even printed. There were no books. There were no books. No temples, no politics, no sannyasis, no anything. It was just Prabhupada. And that was good enough for us because he was so much love, so much. We had no idea he could see where all of this was going, but we couldn't. All we could see was his smile and the warmth and the love that he gave us. And we did everything for that. And we were perfectly satisfied to do everything for that all our lives. It kept us going. You know, I'm now an old lady, 62. But I love Prabhupada today just as much. I miss him. But he's here. He's not gone. He's watching over this movement. He sees everything. He's not ordinary like us. We don't know where we will go when we leave this world. You have to have this faith, and he will actually come to you in your dreams and instruct you. I've got this experience, and maybe many of you also have this experience as well. Anyway, so we met Srila Prabhupada. You're asking me, specifically the interaction, or we met him in San Francisco, and he just arrived there. He was only there for a couple of days. We did not greet him at the airport because we didn't know yet, but I was already practicing yoga from some previous life. I had some inclination toward meditation and yoga. And so I was practicing yoga. I had a little book. I don't know where I got it because yoga wasn't well known in America at that time. Somehow or other it came to me. And I was a vegetarian and practicing yoga and celibate. All the rules, everything already naturally. Because my yoga book said, when the chela is ready, the guru will appear. So I was waiting for that guru to appear. I mean, I was conscious. I don't know how I was thinking this, because I was raised like an American. But somehow from previous life, I was thinking this. And so I saw one magazine, which was, if you knew what the early Back to Godheads were, they had nothing like the Back to Godheads now. There was a machine called a mimeograph machine. This is before computers. This is 1966. Okay, computers weren't around. And it was a very crude type of printing, but I was extremely attracted to it, and I went and opened it, and I read Hayagriva Das's article about meeting Srila Prabhupada on the street in New York, how he is dressed in the saffron robes and the pointy-toed shoes, and he looked like he was a genie that popped out of the lamp. I don't know if you're as an American, you know, understand. And so Hayagriva went across the street to say, are you from India? Duh. You know, are you from India? Because he had taken a trip to India and he'd seen other holy men. And so Prabhupada gave this beaming smile to him. I read this and it was just like, I don't know. He appeared before me. I started to cry and weep. And I just started saying, I found him. I found him. I found him at last. And tears were just coming. So I immediately went to the address that was on there. And he was there. and we had meetings. I think it was Mukunda Maharaj. Excuse me a minute. There's a mosquito chewing on my feet. I've got to put something on. Indian mosquitoes love Americans. A gourmet food. That's what we are to them, you know. I mean, they're something different to eat, you know, so they're biting me all the time. So we had a meeting, and Srila Prabhupada met with us, and he asked us, you know, I guess I was 21 years old. I guess I must have been around 21, but I had already gone through college nearly three years, and I had also gone to Europe and studied art. So I wasn't out in the working world. I wasn't that contaminated yet, but I was quite an innocent young 21. So Prabhupada asked us everything. Oh, you're students? Oh yes, I'm studying art. I was studying art at the university, and asked so many questions about our life, and. And so I said, yes, he asked, traveling. I said, yes, I travel. He was called Swamiji at that time. I've traveled in Europe. I studied in Italy and France. And I traveled all these countries in Europe. And I was so young, I looked like I was, sometimes I flew on airplanes for under 12. So I looked really young, you know. I was not under 12, but I could do it. So I was very, very young. And he says, oh, you're so young and you have traveled so much? And I said, yes, but none of it has made me happy. And he got a blasting smile. Yes, that is required. Because what happened, I was somewhat privileged. We weren't really rich, but my father was pretty well-to-do. And I was able to, whatever I would focus, I would get it. If I wanted to go to a particular school, if I wanted a particular situation. But nothing, as soon as I would go, I remember sitting on the campus, on the grass at the university, and I was saying, so what will make me happy? What is it that will fill my heart with happiness? I was actually asking this. But of course, we get taught, and I just learned yesterday from one of my godbrothers that similarly, in India now you're being taught this Darwinism in your schools. It's a terrible curse to do to children. It needs to be stopped because they're teaching subtly. They're making it so that by the time the child is 15 or 16, he will become agnostic. Where is God? I see no evidence of God. And this is a dangerous philosophy. And by the time I was 16, I wasn't atheistic, but I was agnostic. But when I traveled in Europe and I went to all the cathedrals and saw the beautiful art of the Renaissance, my heart was, I could feel the bhakti, but still there was ignorance. Actually, I was telling my godbrothers yesterday one story that after several years of being a devotee, after having traveled with Srila Prabhupada, and after going and opening temples in Hawaii, several years later, we were walking on the beach, and he began to talk about this word instinct. Have you heard this? Do you know about this? This is a very important point. He was saying the little sand crabs would run. As soon as we would come walking, they ran to their holes. And he was saying, so they are doing this. This is their way of protection. Then he began to talk extensively about how the materialistic scientists, are the Darwinists, the people who are teaching your children in the schools, they're saying that all is running by instinct. The birds are, children are born, and by instinct they're searching for the mother's breast, whether it's a little cat or a little dog or a little goat, whatever. And he said, this philosophy is completely wrong. This is the beginning of the atheism. Because what they have done, he said, there is no such word as instinct. This word does not exist in Sanskrit. This is something the materialists have coined. They've coined this word, they've made this word, in order to make people atheists. Because actually, he was explaining, and he really was on this point for hours, because he could understand that I had been brainwashed by the Darwinists. Although I was a devotee, I had never thought about this point. And so he was making it very, very clear that actually, when the child is born, or the baby animal is born, any creature which is born, it is due to the guidance of Super Soul and due to past experience that he goes for the mother's breast. Prabhupada made the motion like this, going, you know, immediately a baby cow is born, or a baby animal, or baby human, they're immediately searching for the mother's breast. He made this motion. And he was explaining that this is due to the guidance of the super soul in the heart. He's going from body to body. And it's also due to past experience. And Prabhupada made the point that just like the privy is here, and we're in the house that we're in, he called the bathroom a privy. He said, the privy is here. So supposing I come to this house 20 years from now, I will remember the privy is there. This was his point. So he really elaborated on this, and it dawned on me, oh my gosh, I've been schooled in this Darwinism. I've been schooled to think like this. And so he had to rewire my mind a little bit. And actually, this is a very important thing that needs to be addressed. I just found out that they are doing this to the children in India also. And this is the source of the atheism. Because if the child is thinking, oh, everything is running by instinct, what does that do? It deletes God. That's like pushing the delete button for God. So it's a very important point that he made. And somehow or other, he wanted me to make that point because I didn't plan to make that point. But it's a very important thing for rescuing your Indian children from this materialistic philosophy. Is that something? Or is that what you wanted to hear? Or something else? Huh?
Hare Krishna. I was also, we have read your name mentioned in the Bhagavatam purport about the first woman to get Tulsi Maharani. Would you like to speak something about that?
Srila Prabhupada wanted Tulsi. So actually I was just an instrument, that's all. He wanted Tulsi because he was putting deities all over. And he didn't have any Tulsi plants. There's no, that we knew of. Maybe there were some, but we knew nothing about them. You know, maybe the Indian people had some. But so he used to talk about Tulsi a lot. And I used to, when I would clean his room in the morning, because every day he would go for walking, and my husband would take him for walking, but I didn't go. I stayed back and cleaned the room, tidied the desk, put, you know, everything, made the bed, all these things, and had the breakfast ready when he got back, right? So oftentimes his beads would be, I would be cleaning, and sometimes, not always, his beads would be there. They had fallen out of the bead bag. So I have to pick them up. You know, they were on the bed. They were sitting on the bed. And so I would pick them up and put them back into the bead bag. And they were so beautiful. They had this golden glow. Now, what is this? They just had the most beautiful. They were shiny and golden. his tulsi beads. So I was always admiring them and putting them, arranging everything, and thinking, oh, I wish we could get tulsi beads, because there were no tulsi beads in America at that time. So what happened? I was thinking like this, so we went to, when we were in New York, we went to one import store and for tulsi beads. And we called up, and my husband called, and then we rode the subway and went there. The man said, he's an Indian man. Yes, he has tulsi beads. So he sold us some beads. So I came back. This is before I saw Prabhupada's beads, okay. I came back. This is when I was first a devotee. And showed him that we've got tulsi. And he looked at it and said, not tulsi. It was rosewood, hardwood, brown. You know rosewood beads where they have those little notches in them? You've seen them? Well, so we're stupid American kids. He sold us, told him it was true. So that was my first attempt at getting some tulsi. But then later, when I would clean his room, I would look at that. I became aware of what she looked like. So while we were in Hawaii, I was doing some library research, and I came across a book called Firminger's Gardening in India, which was written by some British man who lived in India, and he wrote the botanical names of things. And I found the botanical name for tulsi, Othamum sanctum, which was... But see, we didn't know. You have to understand, you folks... We were completely cut off from India at that time. There was not the kind of communication nowadays. Nowadays you call your credit card company and you get Bombay or Bangalore. It wasn't like that. There weren't phones that were... India was... This is 1960s. There was very little connection. But anyway, so we... I thought, I can find out how to grow this. Now that I know that tulsi is a sister of basil. She's a sister. There's Othamum basilicum and Othamum sanctum. Once I got the botanical name, and there were some instructions for growing in India, then I thought, well, all I need now is the seeds. So I went to an Indian lady, and she was an import lady. And I asked her, she was going to India every year to bring some stuff. I think she was a Christian too. She wasn't very favorable to me. Anyway, she brought me some seeds because I was friends with her. And so we sowed the seeds and waited and watered and waited. And something green came up. So we began to bow down every day and wait, you know. The more it grew, the more we realized it was a blade of grass. Or a weed, but we were bowing down every day to this little blade of grass, you know. So those seeds, they weren't viable. It didn't work the first time. So then, meantime, she went back the next year to India, and I said, get some more seeds for me. And so this time, I think because we worshipped that blade of grass very nicely, she figured, well, okay, they're ready for me, you know. And so... She came in with little heart-shaped seedlings, and we were really happy then. And so we began to take care of them nicely. And then Prabhupada was in India at that time. I wasn't, in those days, there wasn't a lot of, there was some contact, but not like later. And so then he arrived in Los Angeles, and we planned to go visit him. And by now our tulsi plants were about this big. It was extremely illegal to carry them on the plane, but I managed to do it somehow. Anyway, so we took them to see him, and I brought the two tulsi, because we still weren't positive, you know. We thought this was tulsi, but we weren't absolutely certain. We were sort of certain. I mean, it was different from the blade of grass, you know, but we weren't positive, because we'd never seen tulsi, right? So we went to Srila Prabhupada, and he was in Los Angeles, and I brought the two plants in, and he took one and said, oh, tulsi has come. He was so happy. Kartikeya told me, he talked for a couple of hours about Tulsi. Kartikeya, who was his servant at the time, told me that that was the happiest he had seen Prabhupada in the whole year. You know, there were a lot of political problems at that time, of which I was unaware. I didn't know anything of what was going on because we were in Hawaii, which is the most isolated piece of land in the world. And there were a lot of problems. I think that was the year of the New Vrindavan problems or something like that. But I didn't know anything about it. And Prabhupada completely, he was happy, extremely happy. And so then he told how important Tulsi was, and he told a story of Tulsi, how she was such a great devotee, and of course slowly instituted the prayers. Well, he had actually sent me the prayers in the mail before, because I guess he knew it was Tulsi from wherever he was. I was not the person who knew. So he had sent the prayers. And so then, actually, to tell you the truth, I was very surprised whenever I saw this in Srimad Bhagavatam. I was like, wow, I can't believe this. This shows how important Tulsi is. It is so important. And it's been a real struggle at times in the West to be able to get people to understand the importance of Tulsi. So I think that's one reason he actually put it in his Bhagavatam, so that people would understand the incredible significance and the purifying effect from worshipping Tulsi. It's a very important for one's devotional practices, because by her mercy, we all know that you gain entrance to Vrindavan. She's the choreographer. Radharani has given her this job. Radharani is the Vrindavaneshwari, but Vrinda Devi, the gopi form of Tulsi. Tulsi has her little plant, so we can see, we can serve, and so forth. But she has the gopi form too, which, of course, many of you must have seen it. Vrindakund, you've been to Vrindakund? And she's holding a parrot on her hand, a yellow parrot, or parakeet, as one would. It's a parrotlet. It's, you know, his name is Daksha, and he has 5,000 or more parrot disciples. And they are the internet service of Vrindavan. So whenever the Vrinda Devi is in charge of whole things in the Leela, what breezes will blow, what flowers will bloom, what music will be played, everything. She's foods that will be served. She's the choreographer. Choreographer means organizer. She's the organizer. And her network system, her server and network system are these parrots. And they come and they fly. You see them in Vrindavan. Whole flocks of them. And you wonder what they're going to do, where they're headed and who they're going to be talking to. So they are the way that the Vrindavan, they're a part of the Vrindavan Leela. It's a very much more exalted than anything I can understand, but I can at least appreciate it. And Vrindakund, as you probably know, was donated to ISKCON by Madhav Baba. He is known as Vrindakund Baba. Are you familiar with this? Have you heard of Madhav Baba, old saint that donated Vrindakund? There was an article in 1993 I wrote about him. He died in the guest house there. And he used to say, Srila Prabhupada, he knew everything. He could do anything and everything. But he was old Brijbasi who had developed, he had cultivated Vrindakund. So Tulsi is very, very important in our line. And I think that's why this is mentioned in here. Certainly, I'm not anything special. And one interesting thing, I was traveling once with Srila Prabhupada years later. I was in Mississippi. Sometimes I would just go and travel. And wherever he was going, I would go there. That was my vacations. That's what I did for fun, as you want to call it. You know, I would go and... So when he would be... Because this is years later, when he became big, famous, well-known all over the world, right? So I would just go get a plane and go and hang out and, you know, just so I could see him and hear him speak. And I happened to be in Mississippi at the farm. He came there to the farm. And he mentioned the Tulsi in a lecture, and he said, yes, Govindasi has grown, I send her the seeds. And then I thought, what? And then I said, of course he sent you the seeds. Of course he sent me the seeds. But that is what he said in the lecture. I sent her the seeds. He sent me the seeds through the lady because he knew what I was wanting, because the spiritual master is knowing the heart of all his disciples. Doesn't matter if he's in India or around the world, Prabhupada knew exactly every disciple, mind and heart, at all times. He even wrote me a letter once. I know your mind. So he can see everything. And he still can, by the way. So don't think anybody can hide anything from Srila Prabhupada. He's right there watching us, hearing this lecture, hearing everything. He's very present. He's watching over this movement. Some things had to happen, maybe. And it was hard to understand. Why did they have to happen? But that's a whole separate subject. I was thinking of something I wanted to say. Yes. The last time I think I was in Bombay was... No, maybe it was another time I was in Bombay. 70s. Prabhupada was here. He was staying at Juhu. And he was ailing a little bit. His hands were a little swollen and his feet were a little swollen. But that was in December or January of 1976. December, before the Kumbh Mela. Before the Kumbh Mela took place. He was in Vrindavan, and I went to Vrindavan. You know, I went traveling in to be around him. And so he was in Vrindavan, then for a few days he was there. Then he went to Bombay, and we followed. I was traveling with one of my girlfriends, Kusha Devi. I don't know if you know Kusha Devi. She was married to Shrutakirti for 26 years. She's been here many times in India. She's had a little child, 3 years old. And we traveled to Bombay, and Prabhupada was speaking. And I was sitting in the room and listening to him speak, and he desiccated this yogi. He was really heavy. And this yogi was a very beautiful yogi. He had beautiful hair, and he had a beautiful silk kurta, white silk kurta. And he was very handsome. And very charming, very, you know, obviously he was an important person. And Prabhupada just laid into him. You should preach the movement of Lord Chaitanya. Don't cheat people. Don't give them, you give them the truth. And he was really heavy. I'd never seen him preach like this. In the West, he didn't preach like this. He was so, because the people don't have the background or the understanding or the, you know, the history. But he was really philosophically going through every point with this so-called, I guess he was a teacher of some sort, a yoga teacher or some kind of a, maybe a guru probably of some sort. That was so impressive. I'd never heard anything like it. So after the yogi left, I said, Srila Prabhupada, you're wonderful in India. I'd never seen him preaching in India. You're wonderful. And he said, Hare Krishna. Became very humble. Hare Krishna. Like, almost like, he was always talking about his spiritual master. He always felt his Guru Maharaj was right next to him. At all times. Because I would, being a young girl, I was very attached to him like a father. Because I was 21, he's 70s. So he was like a father or a grandfather even. So I would cry whenever I would leave. The natural, you know, it was just natural for a young girl to cry when she's leaving her father, right? And he would say, don't feel separation from me. I'm always there. I never feel separation from my Guru Maharaj. But you are Oman, so it is nature. Very gentle, very sweet. He was so sweet to all of the... He was so gentle and so loving to all of the devotees. There was no... Unless somebody really had bad motives, that was a different story. If somebody... He could see. He could see what a person is thinking. What a person is... What is the motive of the heart. And then he could be like a lion. You know? I never, fortunately, really experienced that. The worst that I got was, why did I burn the peanuts? And that was, you know, getting in trouble for things like burning the peanuts and that sort of thing. But I saw other things, you know, that where he was simply correcting with love. It wasn't with anger. It was with love. You have to ask me questions because I'm not prepared. I didn't like write anything. I'm not really prepared, you know, for speaking. I can remember many things, but I have to be prompted. Yeah? I can't hear you, but the bringing the microphone. Do I know you? You're Haldi. I mean, you're a Westerner.
Yeah. A little, I don't know. I've met you a couple of times, but...
What is your good name, please?
I'm Soma Das. Soma Das.
Soma Das.
From New Vrindavan.
From where?
New Vrindavan.
Oh, from New Vrindavan.
Yeah. But I was wondering how you joined in San Francisco, and then somehow you traveled with Srila Prabhupada to New York or New Jersey, and you were there for a while.
Yeah.
I was just wondering why and how that happened.
Oh, okay. That's easy. That's an easy one. I don't have to think. Actually, we went to Frisco from the University of Texas. That's about 3,000 miles away. We didn't know where we were going. We just went to San Francisco. That means Krishna was guiding us within the heart. And then as soon as we got there, Prabhupada arrived. But we didn't know that, see. There was no publicity. We didn't know anything like that. So we were there for about 2 months. Prabhupada spoke every day. Oh, this is the most wonderful part. I have to tell this part. I'm sorry. Don't let me get off of that. But something just came that was very important. This is a realization that I had recently. And I wrote it down in my diary that when we had the initial meeting with Srila Prabhupada, and I told him that I had traveled all this. And he said, oh, you know, and I said, oh, none of it made me happy. And my husband was there also. And he was a 22-year-old draft-eligible male who just left school. So anybody from America knows that that means that you're a target for the Vietnam War. So he was in great anxiety that he was going to be drafted into this useless war. So he had so many mental anxieties over this. And he talked about that to Srila Prabhupada. And I talked about the fact that I had not found happiness in anywhere in this world. And we told him about our college and all this. So then he said, and this is a very important instruction, he said, you simply come to my classes morning and evening and all problems will be solved. Now, we believed him, panacea, that means all problems solved, and we started doing it. And you know what? That still applies. That still applies to the situation now. We were so, especially my husband was extremely, I mean, he was in more distress than I was because it was just a matter of time before the draft board got him. In those days, you were either in school or you were in Vietnam. And so immediately, Prabhupada's answer was, simply come to my classes morning and evening and all problems will be solved. And you know, if this one instruction is taken even now, where you simply hear from Srila Prabhupada morning and evening, it's true. It really works. I recently dealt with a Guru Kuli who had never listened to Prabhupada lectures for many, many years, 25 years or something like that, you know. And as soon as she started listening to his lectures, her mind became settled. These lectures are so powerful. Prabhupada's presence are in his books, and they're also in his voice. There's a statement in Srimad Bhagavatam, actually, I don't have it. I have it in my luggage. I carry it with me everywhere I go. Some scholar here may know the exact page of it, but basically it says that the voice of the pure devotee, the sound vibration when the pure devotee speaks, is may seem like an ordinary sound vibration, but actually it's not, because it is coming, it is tinged with the saffron dust of the lotus feet of the Lord. And when it enters the ears of the sleeping living entity and penetrates the heart, it awakens the living entity. And I didn't quote that very well, but if somebody knows where the verse is, they can quote it. And this is so true. So I would encourage everyone to listen to Prabhupada's tapes. This is, I think, something that can save this whole movement from any kind of going astray, is listening to his lectures. Now back to your question. That was an important point I wanted to bring. So we were for 2 months there in San Fran, and we were going every day to his classes and listening very intently. And I couldn't understand his accent at first because he had a strong Bengali English. And I remember I prayed, I want to understand his accent. Please give me the ability. And it was amazing. Immediately I could understand his. I never had any more trouble understanding him. In fact, I would have to translate for other people. You know, I could understand everything he said after that. So that gave me a lot of faith. And so we sat and listened to his lectures for 2 months. And then he said he was going back to New York. Well, we didn't have anything else going for us. We had left college, and as far as I was concerned, he was everything. You know, I wrote him a poem once. Your room was the whole world, and you were all the people. That means that we wanted to learn from him. So we asked him, can we go? And he said, certainly. And we didn't have any roots in San Francisco. Like a lot of the other people, they had roots there. They had jobs, I don't know if they had jobs. A lot of them were really in the hippie thing. We couldn't relate to that also. It was very alien to us, actually. So as soon as he said yes, then my husband went out on the street and he found a sign saying, car going to New York, need riders, you know. So we left, I think we got ready in an hour and got this car where it took 4 days to drive across from one end of America to the other. And we got there like a couple of days after he arrived. So then we continued. We actually were sleeping on the floor of the New York temple at first. Boy, I can't do that anymore. I mean, it was a concrete floor on a blanket, but, you know, when you're young. And, we were like sardines, you know what I mean? Just like Brahmananda, Gargamuni. We were all just sleeping on the floor because there was no place. Then we stayed with Satsarup. That was just for a day or so. Then we stayed with Satsarup Maharaj at his apartment. And I remember hearing this typing going on at 3 in the morning. What the heck is going on? Somebody's typing at 3 in the morning? And he was transcribing Prabhupada's tapes, even at that time, of Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam. He did some very, very, very significant service. Very dedicated service. So we were there for, I guess we came in March or something, right after Gaur Purnima we came. And then in May, we were there every day listening to his lectures. He was speaking on the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. And he was really into Lord Nrisimhadeva at that time. Whatever he would be translating early in the morning, he would get up early in the morning and translate, you know. He would use a dictaphone. Do you know what is a dictaphone? So he would get up early in the morning, maybe two, depend on, you know, maybe 2 o'clock, maybe 1 o'clock, maybe depending on when he went to bed. He only slept for 2 or 3 hours. I don't think he slept at all, actually. But anyway, he was translating that part of the Nrisimhadeva part. I don't actually know what he was translating at that time because I didn't type the lectures. But for whatever reason, he asked us to do the book on Prahlad. I don't know if you ever saw the children's book on Prahlad. Have you ever seen the little drawings, the little pictures of, it's a 25-page, you've seen it, the Prahlad book? Yeah, haven't you? It's little paintings of Prahlad, right?
Yeah, I've seen it. I used to read it every night to my kids before they would go to bed.
What?
I used to read that book to my children before they would go to bed.
Yeah, know what I'm talking about. Okay, well, those aren't very good paintings. I can do better now. But this was the very beginning, and because we were art students, Prabhupada immediately engaged us in doing art. The very first meeting we had with him, he dovetailed us with what we were already doing. That was his incredible ability to immediately engage people in and turn it toward Krishna. The very first meeting, he asked us to do. I did a 4x4 painting of Radha and Krishna and the cow, and I didn't even know who Radha and Krishna and the cow were, but that didn't matter. You know, he had us do it, and then I did a painting of him, which he specifically requested. With the Panchatantra dancing, a painting of the Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasan with just this bust part, and a painting of Lord Chaitanya dancing in Sankirtan. And he requested that Lord Chaitanya make it so the painting behind his head, Lord Chaitanya's foot is touching his head. So I did that. That was the first artwork that I did. So then we went to New York, as I said. I don't want to get off the track here. And we went to New York, and Prabhupada asked us to do this. He had in mind a slideshow for children. He had a lot of things in mind that I was unaware of, but I just did, you know, whatever he told me to do. So he would guide us on each one of the paintings. And the wonderful thing was, he would come in and he posed for Hiranyakashipu, showing us what it was like to stand on tippy toes. And he posed for Lord Nrisimhadeva every day. He loved coming in and telling the story of, I say coming in, there was a two-room apartment in New York. You know that place? So his room is here, and we were staying elsewhere, but my husband and I and Jadarani would sit in the other room and paint all day. We would go to the class in the morning, have prasadam, and then we were in the other room, right next to his room, and there was a window between. So we can talk to him, you know. There was a window between the two rooms. And he would come in and check on our work. He would come look at it. And he would tell the story of Lord Nrisimhadeva. At that time, I didn't really understand about being immersed. I was a brand new devotee, only 2 months. I didn't understand about being immersed in Leela. But he was really immersed in the Nrisimha Leela at that time. Because he would say how Hiranyakashipu hit the pillow and roar. And he would raise his arm, his like this, and his eyes, you know, the white would roar. And he would come and do this every day. This was an everyday occurrence. And we would be just like, oh, okay. I didn't understand that he was absorbed in that mood. I had no idea, you know. Anyway, he would tell us different things, how to paint the paintings. There is one painting. It's very funny. One painting where Prahlad is being poked by these demons. You know, these tails and the horns and all this stuff. They've got them in this boiling oil and stuff. And we don't have a Bhagavatam. Remember, you got to remember that this is all Prabhupada is telling us this, right? So I'm trying to figure out what these demons are supposed to look like on paper, because I got to draw these demons. So I go and I talk to him, and he says, "Oh, they have horns and they're ugly and teeth and, you know, all like that." And so then I'm drawing, and he said, "Yeah, those are good demons." This is, and then he said something like, "Yes, they have such demons. Even now there are such demons in dark parts of Africa and so forth." And I said, "You mean they have these kind of things? These kind of demons? They have them?" And, "Oh yes, there's abominable snowmen and so many things." And I said, "I didn't know that." And he said, "There are many things you do not know." Did you hear what I said? "There are many things you do not know." And I was like, oh. I mean, here I'm coming from college, right? I don't know that there are demons like this wandering around in wherever. And he so beautifully put it that there are many things you don't know. That really touched my heart, that like, wow, yeah, there are a lot of things I don't know, huh? So, is it time to stop now for prasadam? Have I overstayed my welcome? Anyway, it's like a time warp, isn't it? Whenever you talk about Prabhupada, it's like going back in the past. And it's really, it's like he's so present. It's really, it feels really wonderful to everyone. Because he is present. He's present in his glories. He's present in his books. He's present in his words. And he even says it, "My Guru Maharaj lives forever." You know? So it's true. So anyway, so we were there in New York to answer your question. I'm sorry, I keep getting sidetracked. And then we were there in New York. And then every day going to class in the morning, and class in the evening, and during the day painting in his apartment. I mean, that's as good as it gets. It was wonderful, you know. And so he, everything was going on very nicely. We were working on the Prahlad book, and all was going on. But suddenly he got sick. It was in May, I believe, or early June. I think it was in late May or early June. And Srila Prabhupada had a stroke, or it was a stroke, I think. But we were so ignorant, we didn't even know what it was. And we didn't know that, we didn't really understand what happened, you know. And because I didn't know that much about medical things. We were children. And so he got very, we were there though, we were all around him at that time. And it was a very painful time. Like I said, there was a window between the two rooms. Jadarani and myself and a couple other devotees were perched at the window, because not everybody, his room was tiny. The rooms were very, very small. They were really small, you know, 10 by 12 or something like that. So only two or three of the boys were in the room, and the rest of us were perched at the window, and we were watching. And this was, for me, my initiation, because I had been initiated in San Francisco already, in blue jeans, by the way, and I actually had been a devotee a couple of months. But seeing Srila Prabhupada at this time was a very, very profound experience for me, because I saw his love for us. He was, from all practical purposes, leaving this world. It looked, I mean, he was shaking all over, I guess from a stroke. I don't know how the medical aspect is, but he was trembling. But he would have Brahmananda and Satrup, or one of the devotees that were there, sit him up. He couldn't sit up. They would sit him up and open his Bhagavatam, which was, of course, in Sanskrit. Not, we didn't have these, right? Open his Bhagavatam, and he would continue teaching. He was more concerned about us. He was more concerned about teaching us than he was, that he was dying at that moment. It was like, if he was going to go, he was going to go teaching. He was going to go preaching. But the most important thing for me was that I saw how much love he had for us, how dedicated he was to our spiritual welfare. And it touched me very, very deeply. I don't know where it came from, but I had some very deep realization at that moment. Of course it came from Krishna, but what I mean is, I don't know how it happened exactly, but I glimpsed that this, I was raised a Christian, this sloka from the Bible is that where Jesus says, the poor will always be amongst you, but I will be amongst you for only a very short time. And somehow or other that went through my mind that this person, he's as great or as Jesus Christ. This personality is, he's only going to be here a short time. I glimpsed his greatness. I don't know how it happened, but I glimpsed for a moment who he was, that he was such a great personality from a spiritual world. All of this is common knowledge now, but you have to remember this is the very early times, and this is something that wasn't yet understood. And so in my heart, I realized he's going to be with us such a short time. I will serve him in every way that I can. I want to serve him in every way that I possibly can. Because, you see, he wasn't really being served. He was serving us. He was taking care of us. He was cooking. He was doing so many things. He would be in line with everybody. I mean, there wasn't a concept of guru-disciple yet. But somehow or other, it entered my heart. And so then he went to the hospital, and he broke out of the hospital. He really had some very, very, very strong opinions about doctors, which I don't want to offend any doctors here, but he really didn't think much of Western hospitals and Western doctors. Well, they had him in the terminal ward. They figured he's going to die, you know, and they did a spinal tap, which is a horrible thing to do, you know. Anyway, so he was in the hospital for a short time. I went there a couple of times. I don't remember exactly how long he was there, but he definitely expressed that he wanted out. And so there was a place that was found for him. He wanted to go by the ocean. He said his Guru Maharaj, when he was feeling little ailing, would stay by the ocean in Puri because the ocean air is full of vitamins. And so he wanted to go near the ocean. That was his request. So some of the boys went and found a beach house, a small beach apartment, on the coast of New Jersey, which is Long Branch, New Jersey. It's I don't even know where it is. I just know we were brought there. And since my husband and I were illustrating back to Godhead, it was calculated that we could continue doing our illustration there, and I could be doing the cleaning and the, you know, washing the clothes and all those things for Prabhupada. And actually, it's because I had that desire in my heart that I made that vow. That's why it really happened. And so immediately I began to try to serve him in every way. And those 3 weeks, we spent 3 weeks in New Jersey. on the seashore where Prabhupada was recovering. He was healing. And he would go sit on the ocean, sit on the beach every day. And he would talk a little bit about others, how they say there's no life anywhere, and yet there's creatures everywhere, even on this barren beach. You know, he would talk about so many things. There is one day when, you know what a slug is? What's Hindi for slug? It's a snail without a shell. Does anybody, do you have those here? It's an ugly, fat worm that's a snail, but it doesn't have a shell. You know what it is. It's about this long, and it's slimy, and it goes in gardens and eats the greens. It eats things in the gardens. It's very ugly. It's about as ugly as you can get. You know, if you want a body that's ugly, slug is it. You know. So we're sitting chanting in the garden. There was a garden downstairs, and Prabhupada sitting there. And I was a young girl, remember. And this slug came here. And I went, look at this. You know, like, ugh, because it's gross. And Prabhupada leaned over and he said to me, chant to the poor creature. So I was down on my hands and knees chanting to this slug, you know. But this is his compassion. Such compassion that a slug is crawling in front of him and he's like feeling so much compassion. The compassion is the most beautiful aspect. Once when he sent us to Hawaii to go preach years later, we were saying goodbye and he started talking about how go there and preach to the people. They're suffering from lack of Krishna consciousness. They do not know it, but they are suffering. And go and preach to them. And a tear came down his face. He was feeling so much compassion for the people of this world. So that's how we got to New Jersey. As Prabhupada used to say, do you know that in India, is that a common expression? Is this a common expression? Where you touch your nose by going around. He used to talk about that. So is there any other questions? I know you must be starving and it's breakfast time. Oh, it's Ekadasi. So you're really starving. So an Ekadasi is very important. Prabhupada really emphasized Ekadasi. And a lot of devotees in the West, they don't really even know this. And it's so people think it's like missing Mangalartik one day or something like that, but it's not. And maybe in India you have more of a, because of your culture, you have more of a concept of it. But I know many, many devotees don't understand this. And so I got to find out the hard way. I got yelled at for a long time on that one. And I never forgot. I was cooking breakfast. It was when I was first with Srila Prabhupada in San Francisco. When he came, he went to India. So he went from New Jersey. He went to San Fran for 3 weeks at Stinson Beach, and it was cloudy and ugly and weather was cold. So then he made his decision to go back to India. He flew through New York. We saw him off and he went to India for 6 months. Then he came back on December 14th, 1967. So we went there to meet him and join him and start serving him. So in that first apartment where we were at Jayananda's apartment, I was helping Upendra with the cooking and with everything. And it was Ekadasi, but I didn't know it. So I made some cereal. I was making cereal for all the devotees, right? And I heard Prabhupada, he was in the next room, announce, today is Ekadasi. And I said, oh my gosh, I didn't know. I've cooked all this grain. I said it too loud. It was a good thing I said it that loud, because he called me in and he said, you were going to feed all these devotees, spoil their ekadasi, feed them grains? This is very serious. You do not understand the importance of ekadasi. And he went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And because I really didn't. It was, he could see that I was like, oh yeah, ekadasi, you know. I mean, I've been a devotee a year. But I know devotees who've been a devotee for 30 years who still don't understand the importance of ekadasi. Lord Chaitanya gave his mother one instruction. Don't eat fried rice on ekadasi, right? That's the only thing he told his mother. Don't eat rice. I mean, that's like such an important instruction. It's so important. So he really emphasized, and now that I'm a little older, I understand the significance of it, having read a little more, although I'd still like to know more about it, because I don't speak Hindi, can't read scriptures like you can. But I can see that Srila Prabhupada is trying to give us, by the worship of the Tulsi, by following ekadasi, by all of these different processes, he's giving us the opportunity to have the sukriti, the punya, to understand Krishna consciousness. It's a platform for understanding Krishna consciousness. So sometimes if people wouldn't celebrate it, they would forget ekadasi, he said, well, you do it the next day. You can do it the next day. But of course his ekadasi feasts were something else. They were delicious. They were better than the regular prasadam. He would have this wonderful, he would always eat the same thing on ekadasi. It was such it was an excellent combination. It was always sweet potatoes mashed together with yogurt, peanuts fried, fruit salad with some sour cream so that it was creamy and nice, cauliflower and potato as a wet vegetable, and carrot halwa, 5 things, every ekadasi. Of course, if there was banana flour, which I used to send him from Hawaii, I would dry bananas in the sun and send him the flour, he would have banana flour puris too. But generally, that was what he had. So, ekadasi, he didn't starve us. He was he would stuff us, literally. I mean, he was always feeding us more and more prasadam, because the soul is hungry from wandering in this world for eons. And so when we meet the pure Vaishnava, he is always stuffing us with prasadam, because the prasadam is spiritual food and it feeds our soul, it feeds our heart. And I came to understand this after some time. So anyway, you must be really tired and hungry, and I'm sorry I've talked so long. Is that okay? Did that answer your question? No other questions? I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Hare Krishna. What was Prabhupada's vision for grahasthas?
For?
Grahasthas. Married couples, actually. People who are not brahmacharis, but who are living a normal material.
Grihasthas, I'm sorry. I can't know how to pronounce it properly. Grihasthas. What was his vision for grihasthas? Well, he sent grihastha couples all over the world to open temples. He sent them couple by couple. You know that, right? He sent Gorsundar and I to Hawaii. He sent Dayananda and Nandarani to Florida or LA, he sent the three couples to London. He sent them all over to open preaching centers. I think that you can still do that. Of course, now you have a broad structure. We had nothing then. You have to realize that we had nothing. Nobody had ever heard of Hare Krishna in America. Nobody had even heard of it. I mean, the way my husband got out of the Vietnam War was just by going into the draft board when they called him and chanting Hare Krishna, and they thought he was crazy. You know? So, I mean, that's, you know, you got to realize that nobody knew anything at that time. So now it's a different story, but the Grihasthas, the Grihasthas are really the backbone of the society. They will the sannyasis travel and preach, the brahmacharis travel and preach, but the Grihasthas, I mean, it's important to have programs for the children and the youth. Otherwise, what will you have? A bunch of old men who die. You won't have a movement, right? That's what will happen. It happened. There was a famous religion in America called the Shakers. Remember the Shakers? And I don't know too much about their religion, but they believed in strict celibacy, and so they didn't have any children. So the they died off within 100 years. There was no more religion. Gone, you know. So I mean, right? I mean, you can see Shaker furniture and Shaker houses. They made a lot of nice furniture, old-fashioned furniture, but it's an extinct religion. How can you have an extinct religion? No. Lord Chaitanya's movement is not going to be extinct. It's going to boom. It's going to travel all over the world. And the thing is that Prabhupada so many times said, from the children of your children, pure devotees will be coming out. Right? So somebody's got to have these kids. It's got to be the Grihasthas. And the children of those children, if one pure devotee can do so much, just think, whenever all these wonderful souls come in, the earth's burden is reduced. Because the demoniac forces are really growing in the world now. I asked Srila Prabhupada once, so for 10,000 years, the Lord Chaitanya's movement is going to expand? What about the demons? And he said, well, the demoniac influence will also grow simultaneously. And the devotee influence will also grow. For 10,000 years, the devotee influence will also grow for 10,000 years. It will be huge. But at the end of 10,000 years, the balance will tip. And the demons will be more, and the devotees will be, that time will be over, the golden age will be over. So, you know, Srila Prabhupada's vision for this movement, you've got to try to understand that we had no books, no money, no, hardly a handful of teenagers, handful of American teenagers, some of whom were former drug people, some of them weren't. Brahmananda, he was not, Gargamuni, you know, Satsarup was a social worker, but nevertheless, kids. From my perspective, at 62, I can tell you that a 22-year-old is a kid, especially in America, they're not very mature. And this is all that he had. And yet, he was talking about building temples all over the world. He had a globe. You know what a globe? It's a world on a stick, and you turn it. You can turn it. He had one in his room. I have a beautiful picture of him with his globe. And he would regularly look at this globe and turn the globe. And looking at the different countries on this planet Earth. And he would say things in 1967, when we were first with him, before his stroke even. Brahmananda, you will go to Russia. Gaurasundar, you will go to Japan. Telling different devotees to go to countries. We were just kids. We'd never even, I mean, I traveled to Europe, but I mean, Russia was an iron curtain country. You can't go to Russia even. But Prabhupada had plans. He had big plans of this movement spreading all over the world. And the thing is, I used to sit and take dictation of his letters every day. He'd get maybe 10 letters a day, not a whole lot. Later, about 6 months later, in Montreal. We were actually in Montreal for 3 months. Most of the time we traveled very quickly, But in Montreal, due to visa reasons, we stayed for 3 months. And he would sit and talk about how he's going to have a world Sankirtan party. I mean, we had a $100 flat with rats. And he would tell me how he's going to have an auditorium. He wants to have an auditorium so people can come and see dramas about Krishna and hear bhajan so they won't go to the cinema on the weekend. I go to Bombay and I see that auditorium and I go, yeah. He did. He could see all of this. He could foresee all of this. So we're all part of this wonderful plan. But the plan has been laid. It's like he wrote that letter once. If you want to participate, you can't. Otherwise, somebody else will do it. Because Lord Chaitanya's plan is there. I've never had any negative or doubtful feelings about this movement of Prabhupada's. There's been detours and deviations and politics and this and that. But his vision was so firm. And it continues to guide things. Otherwise, you wouldn't have this temple. This is definitely one of Prabhupada's gifts. And this hospital. All the programs that you have for the people here. I'm flabbergasted, actually. I'm amazed. It's wonderful. It's like, it's the most beautiful thing I've seen in many years. Because, you know, America is kind of shaky. The culture, it doesn't foster. Your Hindu culture fosters this. The culture, the karmic culture, outside culture in America does not foster Krishna consciousness. It's like being an alien in a foreign planet or land. But yet, Prabhupada chose that country because people are looking to America. And I look at these billboards and I see they're still just a knockoff of America, really. It's a cheap knockoff, the whole thing, what I see India culture going toward. A knockoff means what's a knockoff? How do I explain it? A cheap imitation. It's an imitation. And so all of this is there, and he foresaw all of this. He foresaw all of this for India, and he foresaw Lord Chaitanya's movement spreading. So the Grihastas have a very big, important part in all this. Grihastha life is more stable, it's more safe. I mean, sannyas is a little difficult in this age. It's not even recommended. It's not highly recommended. There are some few persons who are highly qualified who can maintain brahmacharya and sannyas their whole life. And they may be in India, but they're sure as heck not in America. I mean, that's very unlikely. So the grihasthas have actually, the most successful community in America is what? Alachua, right? Alachua, there's like a school for the children. There's a temple. There's all kinds of programs because the householders went and did it. They went and bought the land. They built the temple. They started the school. You know, there has to be that structure. And then if brahmacharis are more high beings coming in, that gives them the structure to work from. Do you see what I'm saying? They need this. Your children need this. And the way you're raising the children is going to really make a difference in the future. We have so many confused young people in America who were raised within ISKCON due to the immaturity and so forth. But yet they have still love for Krishna. It's amazing. They have so much bhav, so much natural, spontaneous attraction. But due to immaturity, due to the nature of the culture, it was not so favorable. But that's improving. And of course in India, you have so many thousands of years of culture to give that the householder's role is very valid. It's you know, Prabhupada got us all married. He married us. I mean, he performed the ceremony because he wanted stability. brahmacharis in India, it's possible that they can become brahmacharis and their whole life and they become sannyasis. But a lot of places, it's not so. It's they may leave completely. And we had one very, Madhubisa, he just spoke here recently. Wonderful, wonderful devotee. Madhubisa was here recently, right? He just spoke here. He also got married, and Prabhupada was very merciful and kind to him. Prabhupada was so concerned about him. I knew where he was in Hawaii, and I came to Bombay at that time. And when Prabhupada heard that I knew where he was, he immediately sent a telegram. He sent a letter and a telegram. He had so much love for all of his disciples. So don't feel that if you're a grihastha, you're left out or anything like that. You know, the children, the children are the future of the movement. They just have to be trained properly and cared for and protected.
Does that answer your question? I think the deities are open. Do they open now? They're going to open? Maybe you're starving. I think maybe you...